Hey, Sean, how's it going?
Howdy, Carolyn. It's going great. How are you doing?
I am great because I'm really excited today to bring you guys an entire episode based on office-based opioid use disorder treatment, also known as OBOT. So I want to welcome everybody back to the Curbsiders Addiction mini-series, our new series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and tonight I'm joined by Dr. Sean Cohen. So before we get too much into what we're going to be talking about today, Sean, will you please remind the audience what we do on this show?
Absolutely, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews with people we idolize, people we've learned from, people we hope that you're going to learn from, to bring you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and really help you feel comfortable caring for people with substance use disorders. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit. That's right, you can get credit for this through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create a crown.
And a very special thanks, as always, to our partners, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are absolutely committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about their organization at their website, acam.org.
We have a buprenorphine fine episode for you today. With our guest, Dr. Christy Soren. Yeah, I know that was, I can't tell if that's pity laugh or real laugh, but she is.
I don't even know either at this point, honestly, Sean. So
I was really proud of that one. But so Dr. Soren is an assistant professor of medicine and a clinician educator at UCSF. She practices primary care and addiction medicine at San Francisco General, and she is the associate program director for UCSF's SFPC primary care residency and medical director at the office-based buprenorphine induction, or the OBIC clinic, which is the oldest bup induction clinic in the entire country. How cool is that? And I don't think that means the building's old. I think that means the clinic just has been working for a long time. But she has interest in integration of substance use treatment in primary care, communication in healthcare-focused empowerment, respect, and love, which you'll hear a lot about today. And outside of that work, she can be found laughing and playing with her two young kids, which I think she describes as little balls of energy. And so the big thing she teaches us is that opioid agonist treatment, particularly buprenorphine, is incredibly effective, reducing mortality by 50% and life-saving, and that you can treat people in the office with it, that you can help people self-induce or kind of start buprenorphine on their own, and that can be done successfully even in the era of fentanyl with some small changes in how you do it. And that an approach to buprenorphine treatment, but really all of the care that we provide, should be patient-centered and focused on being destigmatizing, keeping patients really in the driver's seat as they are the experts in their lives and the experts in the conditions that they come to us for help with. And so without further ado, let's get to this awesome episode.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Hey, Christy, we're so excited to have you on your show today. If you don't mind, we'd love to just get to know you a little bit better. So can you please just tell us a one-liner about yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a 38-year-old woman who's a primary care and addiction medicine physician, who's fortunate to be challenged and inspired every day by patients and colleagues. I'm also a mama of two little balls of energy and an enthusiast of making reimagined dishes from leftovers in the fridge.
I wanted to follow up on that. Like, what is the most imaginative dish you've come up with?
Maybe you reimagined is a euphemism. It's more like, you know, mixing something with eggs or over a salad. But I find joy in that.
You know, my first thought when you said reimagined dish was you like took the plates and like repainted them to make them like more colorful. And then when you started saying it picked up on it, it cooked me a couple seconds though.
No, that's
but
a
that's
skill.
More practical.
Yeah, that's a skill
ways.
I don't have.
I'm always interested to ask, because I think Carolyn and my stories on like how we came to be interested in addiction medicine are, and everybody that we've talked to is all very different. And I think exposure while you're in training is often so minimal. But like, if you're okay sharing, how did you get interested in doing addiction medicine?
Yeah, the first time I was really introduced to addiction medicine was actually when I was doing a master's of public health and wanted to do some outreach work and ended up with the syringe access program through the Department of Public Health in Baltimore in a block of dance clubs. And it was really focused on harm reduction outreach for sex workers and people who use drugs, and was just, my eyes were open to the world of harm reduction. And ever since then, I've realized addiction medicine allows me to really be my authentic self. You know, I love learning and talking, getting to know people and emphasizing their strengths, and it allows me to do it. And then, you know, I'm also a generalist, but in addiction medicine, I focus a lot on one medication, buprenorphine. And so it's just a totally different muscle of my brain I get to use every day.
That's awesome. I love that. Also, a very great segue into our episode about office-based buprenorphine. So.
Exactly.
Yes, I'm excited to learn all of your tips that you've learned along the way.
Yeah.
So, Sean, why don't you kick us off? Why don't you start by reading us our first case?
Yeah, would love to. So, Miss Z is a 35-year-old woman. She has a history of asthma, and she's presenting to your clinic looking for help around her opioid use. She tells you, after asking a little bit more history, that she uses about 20 bags of heroin per day. She predominantly uses intravenously. And she seeks out heroin, but she says, who knows what's in the drug supply now? I'm sure most of it is fentanyl. She's never been on treatment for opiate use disorder before and doesn't really know much about what the options are or kind of what could help her. And so I think, just kind of taking the broad view, what are the options to treat opioid use disorder that we could actually offer her in the clinic?
Yeah. So the treatment of opioid use disorder comes in two categories: opioid agonist treatment and opioid antagonist treatment. And so for opioid agonist treatment, we have buprenorphine and methadone. Buprenorphine is the one that we can offer here in clinic today. It's a partial agonist, and it comes in the formulation sublingually and an injectable formulation. Methadone is another option, but that can only be provided through a specialized opioid treatment program. And both agonist medications reduce withdrawal, reduce cravings, and blunt the effect of other opioids. And then our second category of treatment is antagonist treatment, and that's in the form of injectable naltrexone. We can also offer that in the office today if we have access to it. And just note, it has to be the injectable form. The oral naltrexone hasn't been shown to be effective for treatment of opioid use disorder, but is still very effective in treating alcohol use disorder.
And I remember when I was starting out and learning about how to treat opioid use disorder, this idea of partial agonist was so confusing to me at first. I'm like, partial agonist of what? So do you mind just breaking down for our audience a little bit more about what that means?
Totally. Everyone remembers that beautiful graph of mu opioid receptor occupancy on the left axis and dose on the right axis. And so if we have a partial agonist like buprenorphine and we increase the dose of buprenorphine, more of those mu opioid receptors will be occupied or will have activity. However, because it's a partial agonist, they won't have full activity. So it'll actually reach a ceiling effect where only part of the mu opioid receptor activity is actually active. And that's in contrast to methadone or other full agonists like heroin or fentanyl, where as you increase the dose, 100% of those receptors will be active. And then naltrexone, being an antagonist, even though it binds at the receptors, it has no actual activity at the receptor.
Yeah, I've heard some of the analogy that's always stuck with me is the dimmer switch analogy. I don't know if you guys have heard it too, but that methadone and oxycodone, all full opioid agonists, are like turning on a light all the way, whereas buprenorphine is like a dimmer switch where it only gets those lights kind of halfway on. And naltrexone doesn't really work as much because the light's off the whole time. But
I like that. I like that. I think the reason it's so important with buprenorphine is a couple reasons. First, if you have a full agonist in your system and you take buprenorphine, it's going to kick that off and bring it down to that half effect, that partial, that dimmer effect. And then the other reason being, as you get that ceiling effect, even though you're taking higher and higher doses of it, it doesn't have full activity at the receptors that control respiratory drive. And so you really almost completely cannot overdose on buprenorphine. So it's an important mechanism for this medication and really makes it a helpful treatment mechanism.
And I mean, you talked about these three medication options and that we can only really offer buprenorphine or naltrexone in the office, but how effective are these two medications that we can offer in the office, and kind of what's like the benefit of using one versus the other?
Totally. For the opioid agonists, so for buprenorphine, it's incredibly effective. I think the most important thing is it reduces mortality by 50%, all-cause mortality. So if someone who has an opioid use disorder is on treatment with buprenorphine, their risk of dying is cut in half. So that's a very effective medication. We don't have a ton of options in primary care that are that effective. It's also been shown to reduce people's unprescribed opioid use, reduce their utilization of acute care episodes related to complications of their use, seroconversion to HIV, participation in illegal activities. So it's an incredibly effective medication. Naltrexone does have some effectiveness, but it's less effective, honestly, in particular that there isn't good evidence that it reduces someone's risk of overdose. The reason being, once it's out of the system, they've lost tolerance. And if they return to opioid use, their risk of overdose is actually quite high. And people tend to stay on it less long. So people, the 6-month retention and care outcomes are significantly lower on naltrexone. It's also harder to start. Someone's got to have all opioids out of their system for at least a week or two. And so for many people, that's a huge barrier to starting naltrexone. So for me, when I'm in primary care or in the outpatient setting, I really think of buprenorphine being my primary option for treating opioid use disorder and recognizing it's incredibly effective at what it does. It's not for everyone, but it is very effective.
Similar in my practice, I think buprenorphine, naloxone, that's really my go-to for opioid use disorder. Something I learned in fellowship is that they're really like two different formulations, like the sublingual and now an injectable. Do you mind telling us a little bit about the pros and cons of each?
Totally. Both are the same medication. So both have buprenorphine in it. And the pros of the sublingual formulation is honestly, it's more accessible. It's at commercial pharmacies, it's at specialty pharmacies. And so anyone can prescribe it and have easy access to it. And the injectable formulation is only through pharmacies that are participating in their REMS program. And so it's much more limited where people can get it. And the patient can't pick up the injectable formulation on their own. It needs to be picked up by the clinic and administered by the clinic. However, if you have access to that, it's incredibly effective. It's helpful for people who don't want to come to clinic regularly, don't want to have to think about taking a medication every single day. And it kind of, its half-life is quite long. It's over a month long. And so even if people don't return for follow-up immediately at 1 month, they still have that medication in their system. So both are excellent options if you have access to both. If you only have access to the sublingual medication, that's totally fine. It's very effective. And we have a couple different formulations of it. So depending on what your patient's preferences are, you still can prescribe the various formulations of sublingual buprenorphine.
And adding on to that buprenorphine piece, the buprenorphine naloxone, another thing I was so confused about too when I was just starting to learn is why is there naloxone and buprenorphine naloxone? Like why are they adding an opioid antagonist within this formulation?
It's such a common question. And there's a common misperception that it's there so people can't feel any opioid effect or that it'll cause withdrawal if someone uses opioids while they're on buprenorphine/naloxone. Really, the only reason is because when someone takes it under the tongue, the naloxone is not bioidally available. So very little of it is absorbed. And so no one's actually, their system is not actually seeing the naloxone. However, if it was to be injected, that naloxone is very bioidally available and so will block the effect. So it's really there just to deter injection of the medication. But there's no actual mechanism or treatment reason why someone needs naloxone in it other than a deterrent.
I think that's often like such an illuminating thing for, I think like both clinicians often and patients who are like so fixed that the naloxone blocks the other opioids or what causes precipitated withdrawal, which I think we'll get into a little more, but you also mentioned a little bit more briefly. So, I mean, I'm still struck every time someone says like this medication reduces mortality by 50%, I'm like, holy crap, like why are more people not prescribing this? I mean, I guess that's part of the reason we're doing this podcast, but like,
Sean, I would love you. I would love to see you do like a very passionate PSA all over everywhere about prescribing buprenorphine in conjunction with Christy to just sort of encourage people to be able to prescribe and use this medication because it really saves so many lives.
Totally. When you think about any medicine you're prescribing, you're balancing risks and benefits, and that's a huge benefit. So if you're trying to balance the two, there has to be a lot of risks or a lot of reasons why someone wouldn't prescribe it. And so if there's someone in front of you who's asking for buprenorphine treatment, really we should be doing all we can to make that work for that person.
And there's, I can't remember, I think it was a recent study like out of Monty that like did the cascade of care, similar to how they do HIV care, and that like not being able to get bupe the same day you want it, like decreases, I can't remember the number, like 20% of people fall out of care. And then each step people fall out of care. So like offering that in the office when the patient says it, if you're their PCP, right, is such a huge, powerful, important step to help them get on this life-saving medication.
Totally. We take the approach of that every door is the right door. And so if they're walking into the emergency department, we hope they can get it. If they're walking into primary care, we hope they can get it. If they're in the hospital, we hope people feel confident to provide this treatment, because every door should be the right door when someone's feeling like today's their day to start buprenorphine.
And lucky for us today, in our case, our patient, she actually tells you she has used buprenorphine before to treat withdrawal symptoms and found it helpful. So she decides today that she wants to start buprenaloxone for treatment. And in regards to the fact that we want to encourage all of our listeners to be able to prescribe this medication, can you walk us through, like, what are the requirements for clinicians to be able to prescribe buprenaloxone for her in the clinic setting?
It's such a good question, because things changed last April, in that if someone wants to prescribe buprenorphine and they are a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a PA, they can submit a notice of intention to prescribe on the SAMHSA website. And after they submit that and get approval, they can prescribe buprenorphine for up to 30 patients at one time. They don't need to attend a training. You don't need to attend that big, long 8-hour training in order to do this. If you want to get the full X waiver to prescribe it to more than 30 patients, you do need to attend one of the buprenorphine waiver trainings, which is 8 hours for physicians and then 24 hours for advanced practitioners. And so it's been a wonderful way to reduce that one barrier of attending an 8-hour training. That being said, we certainly want people to know and feel confident how to prescribe buprenorphine. So there are free trainings still available online through the provider clinician services, the PCSS, and then hopefully through this podcast, people feel a little bit more comfortable with prescribing buprenorphine. But I totally encourage people to go to the SAMHSA website, fill out a very brief application, and you should be able to prescribe it.
And we will put links for the application and some of the trainings in the show notes too. And I want to emphasize brief. When I was giving a talk about office-based bupe and forced my brother, who's a peds hospitalist, to do the application with me so I could take screenshots and put it in and walk people through how to actually do it. And all you need is your license number and your DEA number. And it takes you like 5 minutes to fill this out. And then you will get like confirmation that you're able to start prescribing bupe. I think it takes like a month or two after that, but it is brief. You can do it in a night while you're watching TV.
Awesome. I hope your brother's using his X waiver now too. That's the challenge. Then you apply yeah. And then you gotta use it.
Yeah, that's my next step in convincing him. But
the follow-up to the PSA that you guys do will be Sean's brother. Just advocating. No, it was really pretty simple, guys, to do.
So the clinic that you work in obviously has the ability to prescribe bupe, but if someone comes in, like our patient, and says, I want to get on buprenorphine, what step-by-step, like, what do you talk them through? What labs do you need? Do you need urine testing? Like, walk us through that a little bit.
Totally. I think the most important part is the history, and the bare minimum that you need to get is enough to make a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. So is this indicated? And then enough about their recent substance use to talk through how to safely start buprenorphine. When someone comes in, we do often get a urine drug screen. If they're in a state that they're like, I can't provide that today, that shouldn't be a barrier to access to treatment that day. But we often do get it. It's a helpful piece of information. We don't do any other labs. In the past, people thought you needed LFTs. You definitely do not need those to start buprenorphine. Bupe is metabolized by the liver, but it should not cause or precipitate any liver injury. So LFTs are not needed. A pregnancy test is not needed. Really, buprenorphine and buprenorphine/naloxone is safe in pregnancy. And so it shouldn't really change your treatment. But if you have access to that and someone would like a pregnancy test, it's great to offer that. But no lab tests are needed. Really, it's your history taking and talking through the patient about their substance use and about what their hopes are for starting buprenorphine treatment. It is helpful to know if they've ever had experience with buprenorphine today. And so, you know, this patient here, I'd probably ask her a little bit about, like, do you remember how you started it? What were you feeling before you started it? Do you know what you took? Often people have a lot of experience through buprenorphine treatment in other settings, or from people on the street, people, friends that they've encountered, colleagues. And so they have a lot of experience to draw from, and really leaning on that, leaning on their own experiences can be really helpful. So my most important thing is, like, walking them through actually how to start it on their own. We have the ability to do this in the office, but I'd say 97% of people want to do this on their own when they're in a space where they can feel they can go into enough withdrawal and feel like they're comfortable and supported outside of clinic, and so can prepare for that. And so it's a lot of coaching people how to do it on their own, how to do it outside the office setting. The biggest thing is kind of my go-to things are if they're using short-acting opioids, so heroin, pills like morphine or oxycodone, they should wait 12 hours and they should wait till they have at least 3 withdrawal symptoms. And I often ask them, you know, what are the first symptoms of withdrawal you feel? And they'll walk me through maybe feeling a little bit of anxiety, some nausea, some muscle aches. And I'm like, great. Once you have those and it's been 12 hours, you should be okay to start buprenorphine. I do also prescribe some of the ancillary medications for withdrawal, including clonidine, hydroxyzine, ondansetron, loperamide, or offer them if that would help them wait a little bit longer or if they're worried about having any of those symptoms and being able to tolerate the withdrawal symptoms. And then what I coach them through is your first day of starting buprenorphine, it's all about getting out of withdrawal. And so that first dose, if it's been 12 hours and 3 symptoms, you're good to go. I often start with 4 to 8 milligrams for that first dose and then instruct them to wait an hour or two. If they're still feeling withdrawal, to take another dose, wait an hour or two. And again, being the day of that, the goal of that first day is to get out of withdrawal and to be really feeling comfortable on it. You know, I do also talk to people about what do you do in the event you take it and you feel worse, just to anticipate if they're having severe withdrawal symptoms or uncomfortable withdrawal symptoms, that often they have the power to treat those by giving themselves more buprenorphine. So often the answer is more buprenorphine and or some of those other medications like hydroxyzine or clonidine to help them get through some of those uncomfortable withdrawal symptoms.
Is there a maximum dose you tell patients to not take more than on day one?
It's such a good question because the expert opinion answer is no. I've had people take very high doses of buprenorphine on day one, including, you know, upwards of 60 milligrams. I often instruct them on day one taking anywhere between 16 and 24 milligrams and definitely give them enough buprenorphine to take up to 24 milligrams. I know we'll talk about this, but in the era of fentanyl, sometimes people need more. And so I do, especially if someone's using fentanyl, give them the option to get to 24 and even 32 at times. The FDA approved maximum dose is 24 milligrams. And I think if you read a lot of the, you know, the textbooks or the traditional induction guides, they'll recommend not going above 16 milligrams. But honestly, it is, if someone has an opioid use disorder, has a tolerance to opioids, it is safe to exceed that. And really, they should be getting themselves out of withdrawal on day one. They should be feeling comfortable by the end of that day.
I mean, I've done a lot of bup inductions, and after you described it, I feel more comfortable now doing more of them. So I assume you're going to summarize this now, Carolyn.
That's exactly what I was going to do because it was such a great intro to doing it. So basically, someone's on short-acting opioids. You ask the individual to stop for about 12 hours. So in my practice, usually a patient like elects to do this and sort of sleep through, you know, most of those 12 hours or try the best they can to. And then as long as they have at least three withdrawal symptoms and it's been 12 hours, you tell them that they can take their first dose of buprenorphine, which can be somewhere between the range of 4 to 8 milligrams, and they can continue taking buprenorphine probably every couple of hours till their withdrawal symptoms are managed. And typically, we often say most of our patients will need somewhere between 16 and 24 milligrams on day one as an average. And of course, you can prescribe additional medications to help people through those first couple of days, like clonidine, hydroxyzine, loperamide, ibuprofen for myalgias. Anything else I'm forgetting?
No, that was awesome. I think that's perfect. Yeah.
And you mentioned, and I think we're seeing clinically a lot of like a difference in this era of fentanyl and people that are regularly using fentanyl, whether it's intentional or not, since our drug supply is so crazy and contaminated. But is there, if someone tells you or that suspects that they're using fentanyl regularly or their urine drug screen comes up positive for fentanyl, do you change the way you talk them through this or change the induction at all?
I do. Honestly, fentanyl has really changed a lot about the current opioid epidemic and treatment for opioid use disorder because anecdotally, patients were reporting experiencing precipitated withdrawal when they were taking fentanyl consistently, starting buprenorphine the same way I just described, and then experiencing what they call precipitated withdrawal or worsening withdrawal symptoms. And I've seen it a few times in the office and in the hospital. And what was going on there. We're not totally sure, but fentanyl, it's highly potent. It's lipophilic, so it's hanging out in the fat for a long period of time, slowly being excreted. And it has a really high affinity for the mu opioid receptor, similar to buprenorphine. And so often these days, what I'm recommending is patients wait longer. And then I start with a higher dose of buprenorphine, closer to 8 or 12 milligrams. And this is kind of called macro dosing. You may hear that term. We've also, some people are doing something called micro dosing or a gradual induction, where they start with really small doses of buprenorphine while someone continues to use their full agonist, continues to use fentanyl, and slowly increases the buprenorphine over time. And the hopes being it doesn't displace a large amount of that full agonist as you slowly increase it. I would say, if you're practicing in a primary care setting and fentanyl now is scaring you from prescribing buprenorphine, just stick with what you're doing. Have patients wait a little bit longer, often closer to 24 to 48 hours, and start with higher doses of buprenorphine, 8 to 12 milligrams. This is all based on, you know, anecdotal case reports, level evidence. We really don't know what the best way to start buprenorphine is in the era of fentanyl, but we do know not starting it is not the best way. And so we still got to provide treatment. There was a really cool qualitative study of people using fentanyl and their perceptions of buprenorphine treatment. And they reported that they felt buprenorphine was less effective, although that hasn't borne out in evidence, and that they were also reporting increases of precipitated withdrawal, and they were less likely to use buprenorphine as a harm reduction tool, so something they would take every now and then when they're experiencing withdrawal or in order to use less fentanyl. And for some people, it was a motivator. Fentanyl was a motivator to enter treatment given the risk of overdose. So it's definitely a game changer on the scene. It's in many of the drug supply markets. And here in San Francisco, it's very hard to buy just heroin. It's mostly fentanyl, and it definitely has changed the way we start it. If someone's using pills or heroin and they think occasionally it's contaminated with fentanyl, I don't think you need to change your approach. It's more someone who's regularly, consistently using fentanyl. The other small point is if you're using a point of care urine drug screen, it won't show up on that. There's no FDA approved point of care urine drug screen that can detect fentanyl. And so you may or may not, know if someone's using fentanyl depending on what lab test you're using.
Yeah, that was super helpful. And I think we've seen the same kind of thing, that fentanyl has changed the game. But I think it's worth emphasizing that you did that, like, in this very toxic drug supply that's now killing more and more people every year, that we need to provide effective medications. And so it sounds like for most people, you can really just do a relatively small tweak of waiting longer time period and just starting on higher doses of buprenorphine and still get them onto this, again, life-saving medication.
Totally. And it's easier said than done. It's a long period to not use fentanyl for. And so definitely offering clonidine, hydroxyzine, ondansetron, ibuprofen, all of those things to help them tolerate a longer period without using fentanyl so they can start buprenorphine safely.
And in my patients who have had that negative experience, who have experienced precipitated withdrawal, if they want to try again, a lot of times I'm like, just wait as long as you possibly can. Like, we know it has to be at least 24 hours. If you can make it to 2 days, that would probably be the ideal. And then I think you raised a great point. There are all these other possible ways to start buprenorphine through, like you said, microdosing, also called low dose inductions, or macro dosing, high dose inductions. And hopefully we'll have a season two and we can talk about that more. But I agree. Like, for now, keep it simple. If you're like, this is my first buprenorphine patient, don't make it too complicated. Another thing too that I think is really helpful is there's this buprenorphine induction app that can really be helpful for yourself. It was helpful for me when I was starting out, as well as patients, which we'll make sure to link in the show notes.
Yeah, I've seen the app. It's great. You should play around with it. See what you get when you report withdrawal symptoms, and it coaches you through when to take more, how much to take. It's an excellent application. I like that one too.
And none of us created this app or get paid for this app, just to put it out there. We just like using it, and it's a good app.
So let's ask sort of actually next steps what you would do. So can you walk us through a little bit of the granular details, like how many, let's say you want to prescribe 8 milligram films. Like, how many would you prescribe for this patient? When would you see them back in your office to sort of check in to see how they're doing?
Yeah. Depending on the setting I'm practicing. So in primary care, I often have a lot less access to appointments. In the outpatient clinic, people can come almost every day. And so it depends on when the patient can come back and what practice, what availability I have. So let's say I'm practicing in primary care. I often see them back in 1 week. If someone wants to come back sooner, I try to arrange that, but definitely within the first week, mainly because you want to check in with them. How did the induction go? And coach them through kind of next steps and getting on a therapeutic dose. So I coach them through day one, getting out of withdrawal, and day two and beyond, you should start feeling like your cravings to use are going down, if not reduced completely. And if their goal is to stop using opioids, that they should feel like the buprenorphine is satiating enough that they can do that. So I'm prescribing usually 8 milligram films, enough for them to take 3 a day for that whole time period. And let them know when we come back, if you haven't used them all, that's okay. We can check in about that and see what the dose is for you overall. So usually, 8 milligrams, enough for them to take up to three a day, and always giving them kind of, how do you get in touch with me, or what should you do if you need to come back sooner? So should you call clinic, or what should you do if you're uncomfortable or having a bad experience doing this?
And let's say for our patient, she ends up taking about 2 8-milligram films a day. So she's on a total of 16 milligrams of buprenorphine, and she comes to your office and she says, you know, she's feeling quite a bit better. She is not having any nausea, vomiting, her GI symptoms have all gone away. But she still says, you know what, doc, I do have a craving, you know, every so often. Maybe every day I'll have one or two cravings. So I'm curious, in your practice, how do you decide on whether to increase or decrease the dose of buprenaloxone?
Totally. The primary reason I'm increasing the dose is because someone reports cravings, reports feeling the urge or the need to use, or they're dreaming about using, or they're waking up and thinking about going to use. And that is the perfect reason to increase the dose. I'm often going up by anywhere between 2 and 4, occasionally 8 milligrams if I feel like we're really under treating someone, or I offer the patient, you know, the option of what dose they want to go up to. It can depend a little bit on if you're prescribing the films versus the tabs, because the films come in multiple. They come in 2s, 4s, 8s, and 12s. The tabs only come in 2s and 8s. So sometimes it's a little bit of a math game of like, hey, you're on the tabs and you want to go up by 4. How will we do that? Is it two of the 2 milligram tabs? And is that a lot of tabs to take? So talking through a little bit of those logistics, but if someone's having cravings, I increase the dose. The other reason, if someone's goal is to stop using opioids and they're continuing to use, I'm often talking to them about increasing the dose. If you're still using and your goal is to stop, let's go up on the dose and let's see how you feel. Reasons I decrease the dose is the most common is because the patient wants to get off of it, or they want to taper off of it. Another common reason is someone maybe is having side effects, like they're feeling too activated by the dose, maybe feeling some nausea or headache. Some people feel sedation. And in that scenario, one method can be to try to decrease the dose. Often with nausea and headache, trying a different formulation. So if you're taking the films, trying the tabs, some people find that they have less of those side effects with a different form. So you can troubleshoot that way, but sometimes a dose decrease is warranted if the side effect is intolerable.
You mentioned a couple times if their goal is to stop using. And so I think we hear from a lot of people, where I've heard from a lot of people, is like they're continuing to use, this medication is failing, or some, like, how do you approach if someone is continuing to use non-prescribed opioids, or if they're using some other substance like cocaine or drinking a lot? Do you change how you're using the buprenorphine? Does it impact it at all?
It's such a common question because it comes up all the time. Everyone's goals are different. And I think it goes back to that first point. This decreases mortality by 50%. And so if someone's goal is to decrease their use, to have less harm from it, to decrease their risk of death, I'm on board with that goal too. Let's keep treating them with buprenorphine. And so this can be a really helpful harm reduction practice for lots of people who just want to have less risk of overdose or decrease their use, where they're not having to wake up in the morning and go find their next, you know, their next fix. And so I definitely support patients using this as a method to decrease opioid use overall. And really, you know, it's talking with someone over time about what do they hope to get out of treatment? What are their goals? And sometimes people's goals are to cut back, and sometimes that goal changes and they want to stop, and sometimes it doesn't. And honestly, being there to trust them as experts in their own body and support them in that is really, you know, what our role is as physicians. And so this is a powerful harm reduction tool for a lot of people who want to decrease the harms of their substance use. When it comes to other substances, so buprenorphine, it's only effective for treatment of opioid use disorder. So you know, I shouldn't expect that if I'm prescribing, you know, a blood pressure medicine, that it's also going to treat someone's diabetes. The same way prescribing buprenorphine is not going to treat someone's cocaine use disorder or alcohol use disorder. And so it shouldn't be a reason I stop treatment, because it's not demonstrating any effectiveness there. It's more of a discussion of like, do you want to talk more about your cocaine use? No? Okay. That's cool. Or if you want to talk about it more, let's talk about, you know, what your hopes are, how we can support you in that. I think this comes up the most with alcohol and benzos because, you know, in the past, there was a big warning not to prescribe buprenorphine for someone with active alcohol use disorder or benzo use disorder, the concerns being the risk of overdose. But that has not panned out. Buprenorphine is much, much more effective than if someone continues to use other opioids. And so if someone has an active alcohol use disorder or benzo use disorder, buprenorphine is still incredibly safe, should be continued, and should not be a reason that someone doesn't have access to buprenorphine treatment. So just take that myth in your head and, you know, throw it out, because this is totally safe in someone who's also using benzos and alcohol. Can their alcohol and benzo use disorder have harms, or can they overdose on that and have, you know, severe withdrawal? Definitely. So, but different issue than opioid use disorder.
I haven't heard that. I love the analogy of like treating diabetes versus treating hypertension, and that like obviously the buprenorphine, while it might be effective for their opioid use disorder, isn't going to treat some of their other substance use disorders. And if they want to engage in treatment with that, that's something that we should be prepared to help them with, prepared to maybe refer them for help with if they need more services. And also, I always love the framing of like, is it what's safer? And so if they're continuing to use non-prescribed opioids, it's still safer for them to be on bup and do that. If they're continuing to use benzodiazepines, which most of or a lot of the non-prescribed benzodiazepine market also has fentanyl in it now, and they have an opiate use disorder, if it's safer for them to be on buprenorphine than to be using fentanyl and non-prescribed benzos, right? And so this is all about keeping people safe and helping them towards whatever their goal is, not towards whatever what we perceive their goal should be, right?
Exactly. 100%.
And I'm glad we're moving our practice towards this, you know, because I'm tired of hearing patients say, I was using, so I got kicked out of a clinic, X clinic, you know, when really this idea that we should be meeting people where they're at, providing support and trying to reduce harms and engaging people with what their goals are, you know, even if it's not what we would necessarily think of as a traditional goal. So I know. So let's say for our patient, we end up increasing her dose to 24 milligrams. In my practice, most of my patients stabilize somewhere between 16 and 24 milligrams. There's occasionally a patient who will be on 8 or 12, but generally those are the doses I tend to see. So I'm curious, in your practice, how do you provide therapeutic treatment monitoring with her in clinic? Like, do you obtain urine drug screens frequently? Do you do mandatory testing? How often are you following with somebody in clinic?
It's a great question. We do regular urine drug screens, and we talk to patients about it being a way to monitor them taking the treatment that we're prescribing. And I think my goals are primarily to be transparent about that. So talk to them up front, and then also be consistent across patients. So knowing that we're applying it consistently, regardless of who the patient is. And with everything, you got to have a little bit of flexibility. So if there's times that someone can't provide a urine sample, say, okay, that's fine. Next time, can we plan on getting a urine sample? Again, the reason being, I'm monitoring that you're taking the medication that we're prescribing. Anything else in your urine is just a point that we can talk about or not. It won't be a reason that we will stop treatment. And so this is just one way to kind of monitor that you're taking the treatment that I'm prescribing. Urine drug screen, it has been used in the past to penalize people, to cause harm to people. It's used in the criminal legal system. So there's so many reasons patients are nervous about urine drug screening. I think as much as you can, again, being transparent about what you're looking for on it and what your expectations are of how frequently you're going to be doing it, and then being consistent across populations, and then supporting patients regardless of what the results are. And if we can set up that in all our clinical settings, hopefully be less a tool used to, you know, harm people or take away treatment instead of a way to kind of monitor adherence to treatment.
And another thing I like to do with urine tests is a way to empower patients to know what they're being exposed to. Because we've said there's so much, the drug supply is so toxic right now, and we don't have widely available way to test what people are taking. So, you know, if I test a patient and it shows cocaine and fentanyl and they're like, whoa, I thought that was just, you know, cocaine. I want people to feel empowered to know what their use is and provide counseling harm reduction strategies around that and just give it as knowledge that they can, use and determine what to do with, you know, as they best see fit.
Totally. So often patients want to know their results because they want to know exactly that. What were they exposed to? Or if they use something recently, is it still in their system? They're curious about it as well. So again, like talking openly about it is a way to have it be a tool for therapeutic treatment, not for harm. And so, yeah, so we do regular urine drug screens. It's true.
And do you have like a frequency of visits that you typically do? Or is it like weekly and then spread out? Or is it just patient dependent and kind of how things are going?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, like I said, after the very first visit, often seeing them within the first week, just to make sure they're able to start it and get on a dose that feels good. And then after that, it can be really patient dependent. Some patients want to be seen weekly for a period of time. Some patients are ready to have a little, you know, to not be seen in clinic that frequently. So maybe spacing it out to every 2 weeks to 3 weeks. In primary care, more so because I have less availability, but I see them less frequently. It's just a reality of it. And so beginning in treatment, I often try and see them the first week and then space it out from there, you know, every month. And then as someone's really become stable in treatment, every 3 months.
And in your practice, how do you integrate psychosocial interventions like counseling, IOP with your patients?
Totally. Again, this comes down to the setting you're practicing in. And in primary care, I don't have a substance use counselor right there to help with counseling. And so if someone is interested in counseling, at least having the knowledge about where they can access that counseling and or a behavioral health clinician who can help you connecting that patient to treatment. I should say for buprenorphine, counseling hasn't been shown to provide benefit beyond the buprenorphine. So it really should be up to the patient if they want to engage in counseling, and many do. And many find it really, really helpful. In our clinic, we do have a substance use counselor who patients can see as frequently as they want. Occasionally, someone wants to see them every day. Occasionally, they want to see him every few months. And so we have access to there in our specialty substance use treatment. If someone needs a higher level of care, like intensive outpatient treatment or a residential program, it does help to know where they can go to get access to that. Locally in San Francisco, we have kind of a central hub to help refer patients to those programs. It's not required for you to prescribe buprenorphine to know that, but certainly helpful to know if someone's like, hey, I want to get into a residential program while I do this. How do I do that? And being able to support them and connecting to that resource is not mandatory, but incredibly helpful.
So what I'm overall hearing is, the ability, like, you should hopefully get comfortable with the resources in your area. I think as everybody should eventually get comfortable with what resources are available for their patients, but that counseling shouldn't be required to start buprenorphine, which again is a life-saving medication. I've heard someone else use the analogy of like, we start people on SSRIs for depression, right? And we don't require them to go to counseling for that. So like, why this, with this incredibly effective medication of buprenorphine, are we requiring counseling to get them onto the medication?
I think that's a great analogy. It's the exact same. We have a medication treatment and a behavioral treatment. Some people need both. Not everyone does. And so hopefully we can offer them both in the scenarios that they would like it. But yeah, we should be able to start bup just the same way we do start SSRIs for depression.
So let's say our patient has been on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine and has been doing really well. And 6 months later, she presents to your office and says, hey, doc, you know, I'm thinking about coming off of this. So what is your approach to counseling and discussing possibly coming off buprenorphine with your patients?
Yeah, I would say the majority of patients when they come in to start buprenorphine treatment are also thinking about when they can stop it, mainly because no one wants to be on a medication forever. And so this will definitely come up if you are treating patients with buprenorphine. The biggest things I stress is that, you know, they are in the driver's seat. They're an expert of their body. And I also ask permission to say, you know, can I share with you what I do know about when people stop buprenorphine and what the outcomes are? And often they say yes. And so what we know is at 6 months, if someone stops taking buprenorphine at 6 months, 85% go back to using unprescribed opioids. And so that's a good conversation starter with patients, especially if it's been less than 6 months. I often say, you know, with that, I would recommend you stay on it longer. What do you think about that? If it's been longer than 6 months, I start to talk to them about kind of what else is going in their life and other lifestyle modifications they made. This is the same thing we do with diabetes and hypertension. You know, we start medications with patients. We talk to them about lifestyle changes. As they make those changes, they may be able to decrease their medications. And so for opioid use, you know, kind of what contributed to your use in the first place? Who are your social supports? What's your living environment like? How is your underlying pain? How's your underlying mental health conditions? And if those things have had a lot of changes and support, that often can be a good time for someone to try coming off buprenorphine. And if someone wants to stay on it, that's okay too. I give them permission that for some patients, they stay on this forever or for many years, and that's okay and safe to do. And if they're still thinking about wanting to come off, then we kind of walk through a taper plan together and continue to support them during that taper plan. So checking in, how is it going? Are you feeling what you're hoping to feel? Are you meeting your goals? And giving them permission to kind of pause or go up on their dose, and giving them some anticipatory guidance about if you're feeling uncomfortable or feeling cravings and feeling at risk to return to use, we can go back up on your dose and increase treatment. But again, like, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. And so we're there to support them through it and provide them with information. And the best thing to do in these scenarios is to kind of support them in tapering the medication if that's what they want.
Yeah, I love that framing of, and I think it's kind of gone through this entire case of that they're the experts, they're in the driver's seat. If they feel like tapering is the best thing for them, our job is to kind of give them the knowledge that we have, advise them. And I think you've done a really good job of kind of normalizing that we should be treating this like we're treating any disease, right? And should be thinking about it in similar ways of helping out all the aspects in somebody's life before stopping the medication too.
Yeah. I would say in the back of my mind, sometimes I'm like, no, don't do that. Because, you know, we just talked about how it's a life-saving medication and it reduces the risk of death by 50%. So there is a tendency in all of us to, you know, the same way with diabetes medications. No, don't stop your medicines. But the more we're honest about what we know and what we don't know, including that this continues to provide benefit from overdose, the more the patient has information to choose what's best for them.
Christy, we have a very similar voice in our heads. I think when a patient sort of provides us that, I'm like, oh, yeah, my brain does that too.
Yeah, like,
but again, like as you said, yeah, or it's complicated, or let's really do this together. Let's do it slow. I think in my practice, like I'm really like, hey, yeah, at the end of the day, this is up to you. But I want us to do this. And I find that taking our time doing that is often beneficial, I think, for most folks.
I guess the last thing I'd add is occasionally people are wanting to come off because of something that we can change. And so if they're sick of taking a medication every day, if they don't like the taste, we have other formulations. Maybe they're interested in the once a month injection. So just thinking about there are other ways we can modify treatment if it's something about, you know, the form of treatment that we're providing. And so anything we can do to kind of support them staying on it, we'll do. And respecting when they say that, you know, it's my time to kind of see what it's like off of this medication.
And I think we haven't talked about it yet, but the recent guidance that you can actually do start BUP and continue BUP and use telehealth to kind of help augment your ability to see patients and for them to be able to kind of have their televisits rather than coming in person, right? If they're not able to make it in person, I mean, that shouldn't be a reason that you should stop, again, this life-saving medication. Do what you can to meet people and figure out a way to make it work for them.
Exactly. That gives us a lot of freedom to not have them come to clinic and the barriers to coming clinic all the time.
And you had mentioned, I mean, we've mentioned a lot, and obviously we're all huge fans of buprenorphine here and how effective it is. I think we should also mention methadone, equally effective, incredible medication that is unfortunately often hampered by regulations around it. And so if someone wants methadone for their opiate use disorder, knowing your resources. We have a whole episode dedicated to starting methadone and how to start it and how to get people connected to methadone. And so just know that there are options out there to treat if buprenorphine isn't working for them and if they feel like it's not working for them too.
Totally. And that, yeah, it saves lives.
Yeah,
as
we
well.
Love methadone just as much.
Reduces. Yeah, we love methadone just as much. Reduces risk of death by 50% as well. So whatever treatment option works for them. And it's cool we have treatment options. So definitely.
I want to thank you so much for coming on, Christy. This has been a great episode. I think our listeners will hopefully really appreciate and feel inspired to start prescribing buprenaloxone in their own practice. So let's just take a couple of minutes to wrap up. Do you have any final take-home points for all of our listeners out there?
I think the biggest one that everyone probably knows by now is opioid agonist treatments, buprenorphine and methadone saves lives, reduce risk of death by 50%. And buprenorphine is one tool we have in an office-based setting to provide and in the hospital and in the emergency department. And it's definitely within the skill set and knowledge realm of general internists. So we hope all of you will take this information and feel empowered to use it and prescribe it. And then, you know, we all need to do our part in creating a caring, destigmatized clinical environment for patients. And that's especially for people who use drugs who haven't had always that experience. And we can do this through listening, asking permission, and just remembering that, you know, they're the experts in their own life.
Wow. If I wasn't inspired to be an addiction med doc, I'm now re-inspired to be an addiction med doc again. But I'm glad I like my job. Anything you want to plug for us too?
I was reflecting on, there's just a lot of animosity in the world, but there's a lot of good. And I'm grateful for you, Sean and Carolyn and the Curbsiders for, you know, leaning into this learning, and grateful for everyone for listening. Just learning about how to care for people who use drugs is so important. And let's keep bringing some of that love and joy into the world.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Please check out our show notes at thecurbsiders.com.
Really, definitely check them out because we spend a lot of time working on them. We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, review our shows on whatever podcast app you use, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. And a special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support on this project, as well as to ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about them at acam.org.
And a reminder that this and most of our episodes are actually available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals. All you have to do is check out curbsiders.vcuhealth.org, make an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Sean Cohen. Thanks for joining us today for this great episode and letting us bring you some addiction med pearls.